All right, folks. So let me explain a little bit where this talk comes in a series of talks. For those of you who were at Yale last year, you heard me give a talk that was primarily focused on game theory. Then in an online conference, you heard me give a talk that was focused primarily on cooperation. This talk sort of completes the trilogy. It picks up on the two previous talks and then brings in the whole issue of third places. We'll discuss what those are. And says, okay, how does this whole thing wrap up in terms of what we can do in academic environments? For those of you who weren't at either of the two talks, don't worry, I'm going to pick up all the elements that we need for this talk in this course. Now, those of you who were at Yale last year know that I like to start out talking about game theory by actually having you participate. And you'll notice here that I take participation very seriously. People playing the game today will walk away, may walk away with money. And this is not a joke, okay? I'll get back to this later, but it's important when you're doing any sort of experiment involving game theory that there be a real stake on the table. So I always make sure that that's the case. All right, let's start with a warm-up. Let's start talking about being cooperative. And what I want to do is play a game, and because I played this game at Yale, I want to make sure I don't have people who were at Yale. So I'm going to need two volunteers who weren't at Yale. Here's the game. It's called the ultimatum. There are two players. One plays the role of the proposer, one plays the role of the responder. There's a fixed sum of money, which I'm chipping in. So neither of them puts any money on the table. There's, you know, somebody playing the role of a benign deity putting money to be dealt with. But deities being at times a little capricious, there are some conditions on how you deal with this money. So it's, okay, the proposer, the roles are asymmetric. The proposer says, well, here's how I want to split the money. And they are going to make an offer. So the amount of money on the table for this is $3. And the proposer can, in increments of 25 cents, why 25 cents? Because with dimes, this takes a lot of dimes, and I didn't have enough dimes, so we're doing it with quarters. So in increments of 25 cents, the proposer can say, well, I'll give you 25 cents. I'll give you a buck. I'll give you a buck 50. I'll give you $2. I'll give you all the $3. So a proposer can offer any amount of money in that range, as I say, in increments of in increments of 25 cents. The responder can then either accept the amount offered, and then they walk away with the respective amounts, okay, whatever the proposer offered to the responder, and then what's left over they take. Or they can reject the offer, but at that point, they also benign deity blocks out the $3, and neither of them gets anything. You can nominate
it proposer.
As the proposer. So you have to offer that somewhere between $0 and $3 in increments of 25 cents.
Okay, $1.50. You can have $1.50.
Now, can I reject and we're done, or I reject until...
No. It's a single-shot game. In other words, you can either accept it and then you walk away with about 50, yeah, or you can reject it and both of you go back to your seats with nothing
in
your pockets.
It's like an intelligence test.
Okay, yeah,
accept it. You bet.
Okay, great. So both of you walked away with... Here we go, just to...
Soda money.
Prove that I...
Yeah. Thank you.
No? Okay. Thank you both for...
That was a good game, huh?
All right. This may seem like, okay, so fine, so we had a bit of fun here, but what does it tell us about people? Well, it tells us something about how people are splitting pots. Okay? We all know that this is the way to get rid of fights with kids. If they have to decide how to split the last piece of pie, well, one of them splits it, the other one gets to choose. And we know that that works pretty well. Now, the interesting thing is what you saw here. You had the offer was about 50, which is an even split between the two. Now, is that simply because we're dealing with very nice people here? Or is the usual situation different? There's an absolutely wonderful, and I mean wonderful, paper by Henrich and company developed with a whole team from the Santa Fe Institute, in which they traveled all around the world, and they played this game with audiences all around the world. And all around the world, I mean all around the world. So you have everything from different types of pre-industrial societies, and you have the long list here, to, you know, full-fledged industrial, late industrial society. Societies like, for instance, the United States, like Japan, like Korea, etc. Here's the interesting thing. At one extreme, there's lots of data here. I'm just going to use a little bit of it. You have the Magic Wenga. And the Magic Wenga generally don't offer anywhere near 50%, which is what you saw today. They offer about 25%. So it's kind of a stingy offer. Okay? And that's the standard one. I'm just going to use the mean. As I say, there's lots of interesting information, the rejection rate, the 20% pop, but let's just focus on the mean offer for now. At the other end, the Lamellara in Indonesia tend to offer more than half the pot. So the Lamellara are, if you will, hyper-generous. They offer more than half the pot. All right, and you have all these ranges over here of all these different societies. Those of you who've studied anthropology will know some of these societies and will start thinking, aha, why is this the case? We're going to get to why this is the case in just a second. But I want to point out here that in industrial societies, the mean offer is pretty close to 50%, and the modal offer, in other words, the offer most frequently made, is exactly what you saw today, about 50%. So industrial societies where, you know, you might have a first impulse to say, oh, we're probably going to be selfish and nasty, I mean, are actually pretty generous. They're pretty fair. People have an implicit cooperative motion, no matter where you are in a late industrial society. And say, this plays out the same in Europe, in the US, in Japan, in Korea. You get the same result, pretty much. So this is very interesting. So you have several questions here. What's behind this range? Why are industrial societies like this? All right. The range, by the way, tells you that this is not an intrinsic human quality. Okay? If it were intrinsic human quality, you'd expect everybody to be doing exactly the same thing. This is telling you it has something to do with these different cultures. And let's look at the two extremes. At the low end, we have the Magic Wenga. The Magic Wenga in Peru are, here you have a picture. What you see here is what you get. This is about the largest unit you're going to find for Magic Wenga. They're economically independent at the family level. So it's mostly a hybrid of subsistence farming, some hunting-gathering. But family level, it's the individual family. And there's very little cooperation, sharing, or exchange beyond the family unit. Now, that's not because of low population numbers, okay? It's just, you're over there, I'm over here, and we just don't mingle very much. We're not necessarily hostile to each other, but, you know, we don't share very much. We don't have common, you know, religious rituals. We don't have common dances. Pretty much it's, you do your thing, I'll do mine. Thank you very much. And that's the Magic Wenga. And if you're doing subsistence farming and lightweight hunter-gathering type activities, sure, you can do that at the family level. But now here's the Lamellara in Indonesia. Lamellara are whale hunters. You can't hunt a whale by yourself. You could try, okay, but frankly, you wind up being a metaphor like Ahab. So they go to sea in really large canoes, and, you know, here actually you're seeing one of the smaller canoes. There are some amazingly huge canoes with dozens of people per canoe and dozens of canoes going out. And the Lamellara have extensive cooperation. They don't just cooperate on the whale hunt and then each takes their bit and goes home. They cooperate in everything. I mean, they have extensive structures. For instance, while one group of people is out whale hunting, another group of people will be, these days, most of the Lamellara have converted to Roman Catholicism, so they'll be praying in churches, but in previous records, pre-Catholicism was still a religious ritual, praying for the health and well-being of those who are at sea. And it isn't, again, it's not the widow's walk, okay? It's not everybody thinking, will my spouse come back from the hunt, okay? It's really, no, you know, they're hunting as a group, we're praying for their well-being. So this is it. And there's also the development of ways of sharing joint surplus. Nobody eats until everybody has gotten their share of the kill, and nobody eats until the kill is done. So it doesn't matter where you are in the social hierarchy. There are people who act as leaders in different, but no, everybody waits. In fact, there are structures of basically saying, oh, no, even if it's the person who threw the harpoon and actually killed, well, no, I didn't have anything to do with it, it was the group. So Lamellara are hyper-cooperative. So you see that the very structure of how those societies work helps to explain why you would see the type of behavior you do. Among the Magic Wenga, there's very little interaction. There's very little chance to develop that sharing, that community spirit. Among the Lamellara, there's nothing but. So in industrial societies, I find that it helps to think about where things start. And again, there's almost a complex thing about it's so selfish, but wait a second. What was one of the key things that got the Industrial Revolution going? Steam. Okay, fine, we all know about steam. The channels. We all know about the channels and transportation. Okay, we all know about scientific discoveries and so on. But there's one thing that was, I would argue, more crucial than all of the others taken together. And that was the structure of networks of trust that pre-existed the Industrial Revolution. I don't know how many of you have seen James Burke's TV shows, but in The Day the Universe Changed, he touches upon this. It's a beautiful little bit in the show. It's also a nice little bit in the book. But I also recommend getting the book, not just for this bit. It's a very interesting way to look at change processes. But the bibliography, in the end, documents the fact that in the early Industrial Revolution, what got things going were trust networks of people who belonged to the excluded group. What excluded group? The people who were members of the Church of England. The nonconformists. One of the groups of nonconformists that most of you are familiar with are the Quakers. And all the early banks that made the Industrial Revolution possible. The banks that said, if I issue a writ here, it's good in my other branch in America, were owned by Quakers. Why? Because there existed a network of trust based upon this. And that's where things get going. All the structures that say, I send out the ship, you've prepaid me. Well, how do you know I'm not just telling you I'm sending out the ship? Well, it's because you have people who already belong to institutions with shared networks of trust. And then that trust propagated outwards. You read some of the documents from the early Industrial Revolution times, and one of the common factors you find is that, in fact, people tell you, yeah, you can trust the Quaker. Oh, that guy, he's not a Quaker. I don't know. You can trust him. Okay? So it's not that it was trust generalized and it happened to, you know, instantiate in these cases. These were networks of trust that had already set up as networks of trust. Why? Because when you're the second dog in your society, you have to trust somebody else. Otherwise, you're going to be kept down. So, you know, you support me, I'll support you. And from there, propagated out. And this has been a characteristic throughout the development of industrialization. In other words, the successive propagation of networks of trust. All right. So this gives us a certain amount of data. We're going to come back to cooperation. But I want to start out from this basis, that there's something in the society that pushes us to be cooperative beings in the first place, even though there's nothing inherent to human nature to do so. Now, later on we're going to see that we can also be very non-cooperative beings, and we'll see when that happens. And of course, it's going to relate back to this. Let me switch gears though for a little bit, because this isn't just about cooperation and game theory. It's about the third place. What's the third place? In a 1982 paper, Ray Oldenburg proposed the concept. And since then, the concept has been popularized by a book he wrote about 7 years later called The Great Good Place. It's now been issued in a 10th anniversary edition. And then he went on to collect a lot of case studies, and those are in what's called Celebrating the Third Place. At about the same time, Robert Putnam from the Kennedy School of Government started looking at the decline of certain structures in society, such as bowling leagues and so on. I started wondering, well, why is this and does this have an effect? And it turns out that there are two forms of research, even though they don't use the same terminology, are both overlapping and fully complementary. And it turns out also, so Putnam comes out with this book at about the same, a little bit after The Great Good Place, and then he also puts together a collection of case studies that, again, is fully complementary to Celebrating the Third Place. So this is where the concept, as we're going to discuss it, originates. It originates with Ray Oldenburg, but there are some refinements due to the work of Putnam. So let's now put a concrete label on what the third place is. Oldenburg says, okay, we've been talking about places for a long time in sociology. Those of you who are familiar with sociological theory know that you go to Coleman, the whole idea of cultural capital, he's got an idea of place at that. But you can go further back. You go to C. Wright Mills, and there's an idea of place. But interestingly enough, it still remains overall either a highly specialized idea, I'm looking at high schools, therefore I'm looking at this place, or a much broader idea. And what Oldenburg says is, look, we can think of at least three major categories of places. And this is a useful thing, as we're going to see, to understand the functions that each of these categories play. The first place is the home. Okay? And go with your intuitive notion of home. Go with, yeah, it's where I go to at the end of the day, whatever happens to be your notion of family. I'll be very careful here that this doesn't subscribe to a particular notion of family. Okay, so you can go either for the 50s stereotype, or you can go for a fully, you know, modern polyamorous union. It doesn't matter. It's whatever you call home that constitutes the first place. The second place is the work setting. And this is very important. I'm trying to emphasize by using this terminology. The work setting, the NYUs, in the European research literature, you sometimes find the corporation, and that's very interesting because it reflects a certain type of continental sociological thought that tends to assimilate work to corporate work. But that's not necessarily the case. If you're a farmer, your work setting is whatever, let's say you're an Amish farmer and you're out in the fields. Well, it's your community of farmers when you're out in the fields. That's your work setting. It's important also to note that this separation between the first and second place is not a feature of all societies. One. Two, it's actually mostly, not all, but mostly a feature of, again, industrial, late industrial societies. You go to pre-industrial societies, and for somebody who was a craftsperson, the distinction between home and the workplace didn't exist. Your home was the workplace, and there wasn't that separation. So this is not by any means a universal. But for our purposes, for the type of societies that most of us interact with, it's a good descriptor. Now here we come to the third place. So we have the home, the work setting. The third place is the core settings of informal public life. Again, it's core settings. It's not a particular single location. Okay, some people say it's the agora. Well, no, the agora has a specific set of connotations in terms of what type of activities can happen there. Here this is much broader. It can be the bar at the corner. Okay, so for those of you who watched the show Cheers, that was what it was trying to evoke, whether successfully or not, we can argue, but that's our story. It can be the barbershop, if you talk with your barber and the other patrons about politics. It can be, as we're going to see, a lot of other places that you might not think a sense of informal public life. But notice that it's informal public life. Churches, in general, are not viewed to be third places because they're formal public life. There are senses of ritual. In other words, you can't go into a church. Most churches, I suppose Unitarian Universalist is an exception, but in most churches you go in and you say, well, I kind of want to believe in this, and I don't know about your ritual. I feel like tap dancing when your priest is saying a sermon. That isn't going to go over very well. I mean, you don't even have to get that absurd. So churches, for instance, are not third places. That doesn't mean that churches can't have places associated with them that are third places. So for instance, say, many of the churches that run things like Sunday breakfast, but not just for church members, but for anybody in the community, that is a third place that just happens to be associated with a church. All right? It's also important to be that it's informal public life. If the place is too closely associated with your work setting, it's not a third place. The example I always make is the distinction between public golf courses and private corporate golf courses. A public golf course, yeah, that can be a third place. Anybody walks on, anybody's free to use the golf course. But in a private corporate one, it's limited only to people who are either associated with the company or associated with being a client of the company. It's just an extension of the second place. That's important to keep in mind as we go to academia and what use we make in academia of these types of ideas. So Ohlenberg identifies then in his work several characteristics of third places. And we'll go through them very quickly. Most of them are pretty intuitive. These are the defining characteristics. So if you're saying, is something a third place or not, going through this checklist and seeing does it match all or most of these is a good way to do it. Neutral ground. You're not compelled to be a member of a third place. You can choose to be there or not, but you're not compelled. A leveler. While there still are class distinctions in third places, overall they tend to be reduced in third places. At the corner bar, the boss and the employee, while they still will retain certain class distinctions, nobody pretends that they don't, they will, however, overall be reduced, and particularly if there are other patrons who are not members of that workplace that don't know about it, well, they couldn't care less. Conversation is the main activity. In other words, take conversation in a broad sense. Okay, if you have a third place constructed around the arts, that conversation may take place via exchange of music, via exchange of art pieces. So if you have a jazz jam session locale, that can be a third place too, except that the conversation is musical rather than people talking about it. Accessibility and accommodation, again, the third place tends to be open to people. It tends to be accessible to people. You don't have to go behind the grotto, do the secret handshake. No, it's a different type of piece. There are regulars in a third place. Regulars are the people who go there every day, the ones that you say, well, there are people that come and go, but these are regulars. Again, think of Cheers, think of Glaive and all the rest of the people that kept showing up. And, you know, in that case, of course, the actors also wanted to keep the contract, so that's another reason you have regulars. But low profile. This is a little more iffy, and we're going to come back to it later. But Ollenborg argues that third places tend to be low profile places. They're not the glitzy bar. They're not the, wow, look at all that flash and chrome. They're the kind of run-down neighborhood bar, but comfy, not sleazy run-down, just comfy run-down. The mood is playful. At third places, people don't tend to be grim-faced, even if they're coming in because it's something serious. Think of, for instance, bars in mining areas where there's been a tragedy. The bar tends to be a place to decompress. It tends to be a place where you let your hair down a bit. It tends to be a place where you might do some things you might not do in a more serious setting, of course, within certain boundaries, but it's playful overall. So you can have the idea of play. And the last one is that it's a home away from home. Important that it's a home away from home and not home. Okay? It's that people assimilate the characteristics of what they call home to some aspects of the third place. It's not a replacement. We're going to see later when we discuss a little bit of Second Life that this is an important distinction to keep in mind. So these are the characteristics that Oldenburg says, okay, that's a third place. Then along with those characteristics, here's the other checklist when we are deciding, is this a third place? And as we're going to see, how do I go about using or making a third place? You want to look at it, and that's what things are important about third places. They help unify neighborhoods. Places where people might be strangers while they all meet at the corner bar. They serve as ports of entry for visitors and newcomers. You're new to a society, where do you go to find out who to speak to, where the good restaurants are, and so on? You go to a neighborhood watering hole. They act as sorting areas. Now, this is a point that can be either positive or negative. You have to be a little careful. Not all of this, I want to take a minute to emphasize that this is, I do not belong to what several people, I don't know who originally have called the Kumbaya School of Sociology. All cooperation is great, and if human beings could just cooperate, we'd all get along just fine. No, you can cooperate to be really mean, okay, and really nasty. So sorting areas can be positive, such as when you have, I'm a musician, you're a musician, too cool, we found each other at the bar. We get together, we have our own little table at the bar where musicians gather to discuss this. They can also be negative, and this has been documented well during the civil rights struggles in the 60s, when, in fact, the neighborhood watering hole served as sorting areas for who is going to oppose movements towards integration versus people who are going to support them. So you have to be a little careful with that. Can bring youth and adults into association with one another. Very important point. One of the problems that we have, and I do view it as a problem in terms of the educational system as it exists, is that we have a strictly age-segregated system as students go through school. So in first grade, unless they're in a single classroom school, they only see first grade students. In second grade, they only see second grade students. And their interactions with adults are limited to other parts of the day and may be very restricted and so on. The third places can go a long way towards alleviating this by saying, well, you know, you have a broad range of ages in there. Now, bars, for instance, tend to have age restrictions, but other third places do not necessarily. For example, the barber shop, I mean, it's almost, you know, a standard image from the 50s, you know, daddy taking Sonny Boy to the barber shop for their first adult haircut, and, well, they get to hear politics and all sorts of other conversation, more or less savory as the case may be. Healthcare for the neighborhood, it's a neighborhood place, it's a sort of place that if it starts running down, people say, geez, you know, Joe's bar used to be so nice, it's not so nice, why is it not so nice? Well, maybe you should get together and fix this. Foster political debate, again, I won't get into details, but this has something that's been documented, it has been crucial in the structure of revolutions. Help reduce the cost of living by providing common shared services, are entertaining, self-explanatory. This one is very important, provide sets of friendships. They don't provide, oh, you're my buddy for life type friendships. They provide pools of quote-unquote friends. They're second-tier friends. They're not your buddies for life. Those come from another place. But it's the sort of thing, and I'm sorry to keep referring to the show, but it did present some sort of abstracted versions of this in Cheers when you had, whichever character was come in and spill their woes to the assembled group. It wasn't as their closest buddy friends. It was as a pool of friends that they could provide advice for. And finally, they're important for retired people. This is particularly interesting when you look at things such as the clubs that were set up by immigrant groups to the United States. that as those immigrants grew older, the clubs provided a nucleus for those people to gather that wasn't the nursing home. I have to criticize both Oldenburg and Putnam in this direction. Oldenburg and Putnam both take the approach that all these old third places are going by the wayside. This is really bad. It's having a bad effect upon society. It's terrible. And eventually we may recover. But overall, it's a negative picture because they just see these older places disappearing. So this is a beer garden. They see the beer garden disappearing, true enough. They see the barber shop disappearing. And here you have the Shriners. So you see organizations like the Shriners, Rotary, etc. disappearing. So these are three examples. And they're absolutely right. All of these places have either disappeared or started to disappear or have reduced their membership and so on. But they're not looking in some other places. And some of these are going to be very important for us. For instance, they see disappearing the evidence of an older generation of immigrants in terms of places like the beer gardens and so on. But they seem to have missed a newer generation of immigrants. This is a dim sum parlor. I could just as well have put out any restaurant on Calle Ocho in Miami. I could just as well have put up any of the Portuguese clubs that have sprung up in some places throughout New England. In other words, they weren't looking for these. In fact, to me, it's incredible that Oldenburg did not pick this up because he lives in Florida. Okay? So a short hike down the coast that he would have been able to see, as I say, Little Havana and some of the most bustling, vital places. Similarly, these have gone by the wayside, but neither of them is looking at what happens in comic bookstores. I don't know how many of you go to comic bookstores, but you know, it's not just a place to buy comics. It's a place to chat with the other people who buy comics. You sit down. Any good comic book store owner knows that there's always a group of people who use it as a library more than mine, but that's okay because it's a community. It matches the definition of a third place. And these have gone through ups and downs, but now are once again in an expansion. And by the way, the reason they went down had nothing to do with third place. It had to do with an economic bubble in the price of comic books. So this is another thing they were completely missing. And finally, does anybody know what this is? I'll give you a hint. These people are all playing on their Nintendo DSs. This is from PAX, the Penny Arcade Expo, which is right now, now that E3 has been canceled, probably the largest games-related expo anywhere. It's organized by two guys, okay, with some assistants, who draw a comic, Penny Arcade, and they have things like LAN parties. And you know what? Neither Oldenburg nor Putnam ever talk about them. Okay, so they started out before LAN parties were popular, but why doesn't Oldenburg cover them in his second edition or Putnam at all? And there are other things. These people, for instance, are playing Nintendo DS. They could be playing Nintendo DS anywhere. So why are they playing it together? Well, again, there's a sense of community. There's a sense of, you know, we're sharing something. If you do an analysis of this, this is also a valid third place. So while these third places may have been dying, these third places have been booming. And to me, that gives a much more optimistic picture than either Oldenburg or Putnam have, because it's true that some older places have been disappearing, and that has some bad side effects. But it's also true that new places have sprung up to take their place. And in addition to those, they completely miss, even though this is not a question of missing them, but they talk about them, but they don't say much about them, these places. The shopping mall. Oh, the evil shopping mall. Right? Now, we all know the shopping mall was originally designed to be a replacement for the town square. The creator of the shopping mall, in fact, said, I want this to be a center for community life and so on. Didn't pan out quite that way. But if you study, as Henry Jenkins, for instance, and his team do, the activities of teenagers in malls, you find that the use they make of the mall may not be the use that somebody else might make. It's not just primarily a place to shop. It's a place for social gatherings, interactions, etc. I can go down the list of third places again. These don't necessarily meet the idea that there are these small, somewhat shabby, rundown places. I mean, I picked deliberately a mall that's pretty shiny and new here. But they do fulfill the rest of the functions of third places for teenagers. And it's important to keep that in mind because the tendency is to say you're just fostering consumerism. Most of the teens who go to the mall don't buy anything. Or they buy themselves an orange soda at the Orange Julius and that's it. So consumerism is not, it's an appearance, but the use value that these people get out of the mall is quite different. So while both of them talk about malls a little bit, they view them just as negative, destructive influences, not potentially as other third places. And the other thing, and here I have MySpace.com just as a stand-in for all online activities. Both of them barely touch upon it. Oldenburg just barely acknowledges it and says, nah, not really. And Putnam talks a little bit about it, but then he goes into, but this is all probably not going to go anywhere anyway, so it's probably not a real community. He changes that a little bit in the case study. He actually does a case study, excuse me, on Craigslist But even there, it's not wholehearted. So again, any type of activity occurring in this space, as third spaces, they'll talk about. So once again, these to me are also signs of hope. They are signs that, you know, you can have collaborative spaces that these people are missing. So far we've been talking about the bright side of things. Let's talk a little bit about not cooperating, being uncooperative. And for this, I am now going to go to the second game. And I need two more volunteers. So, there's a bit more money at stake in this one.
Yeah.
For this one, we have $5 at stake. So here's the story. Both of you have been named as city manager for your respective towns. Both of you need a new bridge in town because the old bridge is kaput and trucks won't go to town anymore because the old bridge is too dangerous. Here's the problem. Both of you need to raise money via bonds, but neither of you has quite enough oomph to underwrite a bond issue by yourselves. If you underwrite his bond issue, and you underwrite his bond issue, both bridges get made. Now, the profit from the bridge is going to be $10 million, but the cost to each of you of underwriting the other bond issue is $1 million. So each of you, this is what this says, will make $8 million out of the deal. So that's the amount that's going back into your city coffers. So you have to be the best representatives for your city that you can be. Now, if neither of you backs the other's deal, well, neither of you gets to build the bridge, so you make nothing. There's one more possibility. The bids are the official docs of whether you will or will not underwrite each other's bond issues are to be submitted simultaneously blindly. So neither of you knows if the other is going to underwrite your bond issue. Okay? And in that case, if one of you says, yes, I'll underwrite the other's bond issue, and the other person says, okay, but I'm not underwriting your bond issue, then suddenly you're taking home the person that said, I'll take the money, but I won't underwrite the other bond issue. I'll take home to my community $9 million. That's nice. The other person is, of course, left $1 million in the hole. Okay? So the other person in that case now has to go back to the community and say, guys, we now have a $1 million deficit and nothing to show for it. So, of course, this is symmetric. Here's the question. What do you do? And to add more fun to this game, I'm going to have you do this not as one round of bond issues, but as three consecutive rounds of bond issues. Or maybe four. Or was it two? Please, my memory is going. I don't know. We'll figure it out as we go along. There will be some number of rounds of bond issues. All right? So, here's what I want you to do. I need somebody in the audience to act as a neutral accounts taker. Oh, by the way, I should say, the person that does the best for their community, okay, will walk off with the $5. So that's where your stake comes in. You know, you're not just doing this altruistically for your community, you also get to put $5 in your pocket. So I need a neutral note taker to keep track as we go through the bids of what each of them did. Okay? You, Jared, will do it. So, here's how you're going to signal your bids. Don't look at each other. You're going to put your hands behind your back, and then on the count of three, if you decide you're going to support the bid, you're going to show an open hand if you're supporting the other person's bid. If you're not supporting the other person's open bid, you're going to show a closed hand. All right? Everybody ready? One, two, three. Okay, so the first round, both of them supported each other's bid. All right. Yeah, I think there's another round coming. One, two, three. Okay, you support it.
This guy, he told me he was an Abilene Christian community. He's supposed to be a good Christian.
And, oh, sorry, we're done. What we did here is an example of what's called the prisoner's dilemma. Now, it's usually set up in, there are two prisoners, should they rat on each other or not? But you have a problem when you do it that way. When you do it that way, particularly with students in a class, they get into what I call the, I am superior to this. I will not rat because I am not a criminal. Okay? So you have to put it in a positive sense, even though a community winds up $1 million short. And then people tend to play more honestly. So what this is telling you is how likely are people to cooperate in situations where they could do better by not cooperating by themselves, even though, of course, if neither of them cooperates with each other, neither of them gets anything. Okay? So this is what's called a non-zero-sum game. And one of the interesting things about it is that it's an excellent measure for other forms of trickier cooperative behavior than what we were looking at earlier with the split the money type of scenario. One of the questions is, okay, so we did an experiment here, and you already saw that even in this experiment, you still have a scenario where, well, trusted a little bit, but then, whoops, went over. What do people tend to do? Well, one thing you can do is say, suppose you try to simulate behaviors by saying what becomes advantageous to people. And this is what I did back in 2002. I won't get into the details of how the model works. What this simulates is, suppose somebody can learn from their behaviors in the past and tune the behaviors towards the future, and then you select the behaviors that have been more successful over time. Is it the case that in the end, cooperation wins out? And regrettably, counter to what some people like Axelrod have thought to be the case, that is not indeed the case. Non-cooperative strategies here depicted in brown tend to win out, and all the nice cooperative strategies wind up at the bottom. Anybody who's interested, I can give you the details for the model. But suffice it to say that what this is telling you is that cooperation does not evolve naturally from repeated interactions of this sort. So in fact, the type of behavior you saw where one person says, I'm not going to cooperate, actually does not evolve in a simple scenario. However, there are two things that do help when you're talking about generating cooperation. One of them is saying, well, suppose that you separate out into two groups. And now, while each individual would still do better by at some point not cooperating, both groups are reaching into a common source. So say it's two groups of hunter-gatherers reaching into a common source of food. Well, the group that cooperates overall can get more food out of the pot than the group that has a few non-cooperators in. So this doesn't happen individual to individual, but when you have separate groups, then you do have a good chance for a cooperation arising. And Price in 1970 was one of the first people to point this out. And the second one is saying, well, you know, they didn't know what they were doing, that's why I had them just do it behind their hands, blind and so on. But suppose I could see, you know, they had a little list on the side that said how many times have they cooperated and how many times have they not cooperated. Then I'm the person that's the town manager, and I have to pick which town I'm going to do the bond issue with. And I'm going to go to the town manager that has cooperate, rather than the one that says don't cooperate. And they know that I'll be true because I have a tag. We assume the tags are hard to forge, that also says how I behave. So another thing that can work in generating cooperation is having this form of tagging. And these two things can be combined. There's no reason that they can't. So if you're looking at how cooperation evolves, you know, this is once again getting away from the Kumbaya school. It's not enough to say to people, just be nice to each other. That doesn't work. You need to have more items. You need to have some way for groups to recognize who's not cooperating. And you have some way for people to say, I'm going to form groups that make sense for me to be cooperating in this group. So that's something you want to keep in mind because, of course, third places can provide you with items of both of these things. One more thing I thought you might be interested in knowing is how do people actually play this routinely if you do this type of prisoner dilemma scenarios. And if you put people in isolated scenarios, okay, typically non-cooperation wins out over cooperation. If I put each of you at a computer and you don't know who you're playing against, it's even more fun if I say some of the players may be the computer, but let's say you just don't know, you're insulated from seeing anybody in the room and nobody will know whether you made money, who you betrayed, and so on. If you put them in isolated scenarios, people tend to not cooperate. So the further you get them away from a social environment with connections to others, the more likely they are to go into selfish mode. If you go to a social scenario, and this is a social scenario, but it's a relatively weak social scenario. Some of us know each other quite well, but not everybody, etc. So if you have a stronger social scenario, so you do this at a bar where everybody knows each other, then you do tend to get that excessive greed tends to be punished. Okay? As I said before, the classic example is the ultimatum game. But you also do see it in cases of the prisoner's dilemma. When you play it in these hypersocial places, you don't get as much non-cooperation. So we've looked at cooperating, we looked at non-cooperating, we looked at third places. Now let's look at cooperation and the third place. Do people know what this is? it's Cabrini Green. For those of you who saw the movie, this is where Candyman was filmed, or set, I think it's actually filmed in the actual building. But the thing about Cabrini Green is it is an infamous location, because Cabrini Green was developed originally with the idea of, it was already a fairly crime-ridden area, but hey, we'll build these projects. And what we'll do is we'll get rid of all those vice-generating locations. No bars, no clubs, just buildings where people live, and then they take the bus to work, and that's it. These are places without third places. By the way, it's exactly the same in Germany, in France, in Argentina, anywhere where they built this type of project, where the idea was third places are, I don't know, that's the, you know, den of vice and so on. You get these horrible locations, and they're not just horrible physically, these are the most crime-ridden places in the world, anywhere that you want. Okay? If you want to look for truly aberrant crime, truly violent crime, no matter where you are, it has nothing to do with who's in there. You put anybody, you put the nicest people in this type of structure where you deliberately curtail third places, and very quickly the place becomes horrifying. Look at some of the German documentaries that were made for instance on the German structure. Again, it doesn't matter. It's, you know, any population. So places without third places tend to be very bad places indeed, and places that exhibit serious deficits in terms of this type of cooperative structures that we're talking about. Conversely, third places also bring benefits in terms of cooperation. So far I've been talking about it's likely. Well, let's get some of Putnam's data up here to say that it's more than likely. There's good data to show that if that is the case. In case you can't read it, this says mean times volunteering per year. And on this axis, you have church attendance from monthly or more, less than monthly, never. Okay, we said churches were in third places, but this is club attendance. And notice that it correlates very strongly, in fact, more strongly than with church attendance, to mean time volunteering per year. In other words, the more you attend a social place that's a third place, like a club, the more likely it is you're going to be volunteering, doing something selflessly, altruistically. All right? Another example. Blood donors. A good thing, but again, an altruistic thing. You don't get anything. The cookie and the apple juice don't exactly do it for most people, right, in terms of where you get out of blood donation. And again, forget about church for a second. Correlates very strongly with attending club meetings. Okay? So if you attend the third place, you're more likely to behave altruistically, cooperatively in this way that we're talking about. Go in the other direction. Suppose that you isolate yourself so you don't go to third places very much. Suppose TV is your primary form of entertainment. Now, this doesn't mean that TV is bad. Okay? So those of you who've heard me speak on the issue know that I subscribe to Stephen Johnson's idea that, in fact, TV has some benefits to it. But these are the people who do nothing but watch television. That's the question you're asking here. And notice that as they go from definitely disagree, generally disagree, to definitely agree, volunteering is a straight slope down. If you're spending all your time in terms of the telly, in front of the telly, we don't know what else you're doing, but you're definitely not at third places. So a decrease in the potential for attendance, at the very least, of third places, correlates strongly also with a decrease in volunteering. So again, we have some evidence here. This is not just I'm hypothesizing. No, this is what Putnam went out and got. And he has hundreds of data points like this in start. And here's the last one. We're talking here about education. We want to see our students do well. This is the index of educational performance for all 50 states in the years 1990 and 1996. This is the social capital index. Social capital index, we don't need to get into the details of how that's measured. All we need to do is point out that it correlates strongly with attendance to third places, particularly clubs, bars, and so on. And notice that, once again, we have a very strong correlation. Now, this is correlation. It's not causation. I'm not proving that one causes the other. But it's always suggested, given everything else that we've discussed, that as we have states with low capital index in our states where people don't go very much to clubs or bowling or what have you, you also have lower student educational performance. As you go to higher attendance, you get higher performance. Now you say, well, why is the case? You know, you think if a student goes a lot to a bar, maybe they're not going to be the best students around the place. But don't forget that bars are the places where you speak with other students. They're the places where you say, you know, I didn't get that lecture today at all. Oh, here, I got my notes. You know, I can help you out. My buddies at the fraternity can help you out, right? So it's not just a question of the individual. I don't even need to get into Vygotsky and social milieu for students or anything like that. What I need to point out is that clearly, there appears to be at least some correlation here in this regard. Third places provide you yourself with that pool of friends. They don't provide you with the buddies that you're closest to for life. They provide you with friends that are, well, called in general, weak links. These are acquaintance cum friends. Okay, Granovetter's the guy who came up with the term. If you don't read any of the papers, I've got in this bibliography, by the way, I'll of course make you my slides available to everyone. Do read the Granovetter's. These are two brilliant papers. But what Granovetter said is, look, you have ties of close-knit connections, the family, really tight workplaces where every worker knows every other worker. But reaching those different places, you have these weak ties, these weak connections, and that's what you get at third place. That remember I told you that pool of friends was important? All right, that's what you're doing here. And what Granovetter found is that when you find out about a new job, obviously a better job, in context, it wasn't anybody in these close-knit clusters. It wasn't your Uncle Fred who you've been close to for 50 years. It was that guy you met at the bar, and he's a nice guy, you play pool with him a couple of times, and oh, yeah, you're looking for a new job. You know, my factory, I'll tell you what, I'll speak with the boss. I'll see what we can do. That's the type of thing those weak links got in jobs. And there have been many, many other studies on the importance of weak links. We don't have weak ties, weak links. We don't have time to talk about them today, but I will point out that weak ties have been found to be essential when you have a social community that's going to be robust. And communities have nothing but strong ties go kaput easily. You say, wait a second, but the communities are so tightly bound via family. Everybody is family with everybody else. We all eat at the same place, go to the same church, we do everything together. Those communities are brilliant. They don't have the resilience. They don't have the capacity to create the type of innovation that's needed to survive tough times. The classic example of this was the communities that went through the process of urban renewal in the 60s. As we all know, that was destructive to communities, period. There's no other way around that. I don't know anybody who can say, oh yeah, that was a good time for a community. The communities that said, no, you're not going to build a highway through our town because it just happens to be most convenient. No, you're not going to move our, you know, row housing into the type of project housing with no third places. No, we want to keep our bars even if you think that they're sinful and dirty and nasty. Those communities all had weak ties as the overall bridging structures of the community. The ones that were, okay, we all get together, etc., those died. You look around Boston, and the corpses of those communities littered the area. So the ones that were strongly family-based, none of those had a chance. Those that had the structure of weak ties mediated through a lot of third places did very well. So I've been talking so far about third places in general, but you came to see a talk that involved online, particularly something new, 3D worlds. Let's start out with World of Warcraft. You already heard the talk on World of Warcraft, many of you, and I just wanted to point out that World of Warcraft is a fascinating game, but it has a fascinating community life well beyond the structure of the game. And I'm just showing you here, this was for the London bombing victims, a moment of silence in World of Warcraft. Now, I don't know about you, but when you go to play bridge with somebody in general, in your bridge club, I've never heard of people at the bridge club, most bridge clubs, saying spontaneously, let's have a moment of silence for those people who we didn't know or knew anything about. In World of Warcraft, this type of event is not just not rare, it's common. And in fact, there's been a huge amount of discussion, for instance, about things like mourning for real-world deaths in World of Warcraft. In other words, there's a rich community life that mirrors what you see at third places. The sort of thing when you hear, my buddy was killed in a car crash, and a silence falls over the bar. That sort of thing happens in World of Warcraft. That's important. It's worth studying. But since you already heard about World of Warcraft, let me show you a few more examples. So these are a few other massively multiplayer online games and related environments that are of interest to us. This is Lineage 2, a game that's very popular in Korea. This is Star Wars Galaxies. And this is not really a massively multiplayer online game. It's rather the antiportal to it. This is Xbox Live, which is the place where players meet to get together to play games jointly in the Xbox. This is the Xbox 360 version, by the way, of Xbox Live. So these three are massively multiplayer online games. Lineage 2 is not too dissimilar from World of Warcraft. It's more primitive in some graphical terms. The quests aren't quite as interesting, but overall it's the same type of idea. Star Wars Galaxies is inhabit the world of Star Wars for a day. You don't get to be Han Solo, by the way. Sorry, you just get to be, you know, wingman number 45, the guy that blows up at the beginning of the run on the Death Star. And, as I said, this is the place where people get to say, okay, who's my buddies? What have my buddies sent me? Who am I going to play SOCOM or whatever game with them today? And I want to show you that I don't have to go into generalities here. I can show you concrete research that's been done on these places as third places. Ashland's Call 1 and 2 and Lineage 1 and 2 were studied by Stankeler and Williams. And they went through and they did exactly what I just suggested that you do earlier. Go to that checklist and see if the checklist for third places matches what happens in the game. And sure enough, it does. One of the interesting things that Stankeler and Williams found is that the games that developed this type of third place community, not in all cases, but in general, remember that we said that Oldenburg thought that third places had to have that kind of shabby, run-down, genteel thing? Well, Stankeler and Williams found that, in fact, the games that have regulars, where after a while it's not whether you're killing the dragon by meeting your buddies online for the equivalent of a virtual drink and so on, or the ones that had passed the peak in graphic performance, the ones that, in fact, are kind of a little shabby and run down in terms of gaming. All of these games are past their prime, and yet they all retain some type of regular. So they thought that this is a point worth exploring further. They haven't done so yet. There's a very recent paper, as you can tell, so let's give them a little bit more time. But as I say, to me this is fascinating because it's saying, okay, these places definitely serve, no questions about asked, third places. Star Wars Galaxies. Those of you who are interested in issues of gendering will know that Star Wars Galaxies has been this topic of some very intense study because there's all sorts of interesting issues of what gender people play in Star Wars Galaxies. But in this case, this is about something different, which is the issue of cantinas in Star Wars Galaxies. They were studied by Dushnow, Moore, and Nickel a couple of years back. And what they found is they said, well, cantinas in Star Wars Galaxies look very much like bars do in the real world. Are cantinas third places? And they found that these cantinas, which, by the way, when you go to a cantina in Star Wars Galaxies, Star Wars Galaxies has a sort of character timeout feature. Your character is wounded, and so you have to wait. Okay, and you might as well hang out somewhere safe, which is a cantina, and there's other things that go on, but that gives you a rough idea of how it was promoted in the first place. And they found that, in fact, they did match all 8 defining characteristics, but they found that the match wasn't great, that they were too neutral. In other words, people really had no stake in whether they went to a particular cantina or not for a most part. They were low in regulars. And when they looked at activities in the cantinas, play for conversation was not a majority. It's still a significant chunk, but it was only about a third. So it was a match for a third place, but not such a great match overall. But the thing that they've done is that, wait a second, but what about Star Wars Galaxies overall? And while they still need to gather more data on that, they found that Star Wars Galaxies as a whole better matches the definition of a third place. So this is a question of granularity. When you're looking at online places, sometimes you have to be careful that you don't try to match the granularity of the physical world to the granularity of the virtual world. Finally, Xbox Live. This is what Lee gives Hugh and Graham in 2003, so the older version of the Xbox Live. They found that they were looking at a previous question. The question was, is this strong enough to provide the support that you need for something like a third place to grow? And they found that the answer was yes. It provided all the necessary infrastructure. Overall, we see that massively multiplayer games can be used as third spaces, are used as third spaces. All right, MySpace. I'm not going to talk too much about this because you have already all the necessary ingredients you need to actually do this analysis. So just look at this. And by the way, I know this person, Hillary, I'm working with her on a project. And think of all the things that we talked about. That diffuse circle of friends. Well, you have this long, long list, typically all the photographs of friends. You have the characters, and you're going to find that you have some people who keep showing up with funny witticisms, etc., in here. Okay, so you have the regulars. All right. You have the sorting. Well, we know that music is an important factor. In fact, it's probably the factor that drove MySpace to the popularity in the first place. That's here. I'll leave as an exercise for you to just load up any MySpace page for anybody you like and see what third place characteristics are. By the way, Hillary has much better design sense than many MySpace users, but I point out that one of the things that people complain about MySpace is that the pages are, it burns my eyes! Well, that corresponds once again to that sort of quasi-shabbiness that Oldenburg was talking about. So that, in fact, may not be a detriment, it may actually be a feature. Okay, so we have these. But here are a few more questions I'm leaving you with to think about as homework, so to speak. So how does Facebook compare to MySpace as a third place? You find them discussed equivalently. Are they really equivalent? Homework exercise. And now, finally, Cyprian is in the back of the room. He's talking tomorrow about Flickr. So if you don't know Flickr, go to a session tomorrow. But Flickr has been adding more and more features that are MySpace-ish or Facebook-like. Can Flickr be a third splint these days? What would make it work that way? What might not? Is this something that could be of interest to you in academia? So, Second Life. You've heard a lot of already truly excellent talks about Second Life. Today, I am not going to embarrass myself by even trying to come up to the level. What I'm going to start out, though, is pointing out that Second Life has an amazing range of community activities, many of which I've never seen a counterpart to in the physical world. So fundraising activities I've seen in Second Life go well beyond anything I've ever seen proposed in the physical world, and not just because of difficulty, but just because of concept and how thoughtful and far-ranging some of them are. In this particular case, this is for Martin Luther King Day, the celebration in Second Life. And again, the type of let's get together in groups to discuss the meaning of the life of King, the work, what's good, what's bad, what needs to be done, what hasn't been done. I have to be honest with you, I don't know many places outside from dedicated groups in the physical world. In other words, this type of spontaneous creation of places to discuss this type of thing is relatively rare in physical world. Yes?
Lab
still needed
the land to set up 12 sims to replicate major countries in the world. They raised over $40,000
in real money from that
effort.
Absolutely.
Great community.
There were 1,160 of us who ran the Relay
for
Life.
Absolutely.
I heard anything, Mr. D. You mentioned the London bombing, the moment of silence. What happened in Second Life, people built this huge memorial shrine. Where there was actually, and there was actually one person who used to live in London at the stop in the underground where the bombing happened, and they built, this person built a model of the station. Just wow. That morning, he was like, "I'm devastated. This is terrible." And I was like, "Why are you building a model of the station?" And he was like, "I just wanted to make. I don't know. I just felt like I wanted to share. This is what this space was to me." And then people were leaving. Like leaving candles, leaving things that they had made to, you know, flowers. It was amazing. And this was, so it was not just people meeting, but they were also coming together to create something.
Yeah, thank you both for bringing those up because, again, these are amazing examples. I'll give you one more, going back for a second to the world of play. The same people who run the Penny Arcade Expo also run the Child's Play Charity, which, again, is a model for raising money for kids efficiently, no overhead, next to no overhead, and getting it right away to the kids. And frankly, I think a lot of not-for-profit societies in the real world could take a cue from how this works. And this is largely mediated via online third spaces and the third space type activities that happen at places like the Penny Arcade Expo. So one thing I am going to say about Second Life, though, is you've already heard that Second Life is not a game. And I agree. In addition to that, though, when you look at Second Life, it's also not a third space. It's richer than that. Second Life provides the infrastructure for all three spaces. And we're seeing that evolve, and it's a fascinating story. Because many players view it as their real home rather than a home away from home. You already heard about the members of Second Life with cerebral palsy. That's the Live to Give community. And I've spoken with them, and they refer to it as it's home. It's not a home away from home. It's this is what my real body is. That thing in the physical world that can't move without somebody to push a wheelchair, that's not my body. My body is here. And they mean it. It's not just an illusion. No, they mean it. They live there. And when, as has happened, their assistant isn't there, it's literally as though they have been padlocked for a day. Think of what it would be like for you to suddenly be padlocked and not be able to speak. Not just the regular problems that they have to deal with, but literally have this taken away from them. So they view Second Life as a true first space, or first place. When you look at academic and training, corporate training spaces, mostly most of them have dealt with Second Life as an extension of real life spaces. Well, the academic space is the second place as far as students are concerned, and the corporate training spaces are obviously also second places. So in this case, these spaces function mostly I've seen as extensions of second places. I'm beginning to see some truly autonomous ones start to spring up. I think we're going to see a lot more. But again, that's most of what I've seen there. And finally, bars, pubs, dance, art sharing, you fill it in. All of those function in Second Life in ways that are analogous to their real-life counterparts, and these are where you have third places in Second Life. Okay? And again, this is the point at which I yield the floor to those of you who are much, much, much more versed in Second Life than I am, because I'm sure you can come up with you know, hundreds, literally, of examples that build upon the idea of the third space in ways that you don't find in the physical world. I find, for instance, just the interactions of the dance clubs fascinating. It really is very different from at least what I've seen in dance clubs in the physical world. So this is all I'm going to say. I'm going to say that this is worthwhile exploring, and I think it's worthwhile for academic institutions to think about these issues very carefully. So the third place, online and higher, this is where now everything sort of comes together. We've said that third places, while not all goodness and shininess, have certain very important things in terms of what they provide, links, in terms of sponsoring collaboration, in terms of providing all sorts of structures that you don't get otherwise. You don't want community. Can higher ed capitalize upon this? One option is to use existing spaces. And I'm just on top of here, MySpace, Facebook, but the list goes on. I just mentioned these two because they're the first two that come to me. Can you do it? I think you can. But there's the first thing that has to happen before anything else. The attitude towards these places has to change. These are comments that I've heard at three recent conferences, and the last one is published in the latest issue of the New Yorker. And the people making these comments weren't joking. These are people I normally would say, well, they have good ideas and so on, but these were deep revelations of their attitudes until they were talking about MySpace, although there's more general. The first one is just a sort of low-level evaluation. It's all junk. Okay, so you just throw everything, it's all junk. I don't want to get it out of my face. That's the lowest level. Then you go one tier up, and you start to get into normative assessments of this stuff. Oh, this was said about YouTube. We can't let them produce trash. We have to keep them from doing that. You will not produce trash. Okay? And I understand they were talking about providing information, but the overtones were not just provide information and ways of assessing what I'm doing, effective or good or what have you. It was much more, interdiction. Go up one tier. Okay? Forget about fixing it for them, so to speak. Block it off altogether. And again, this was a quote. If Phil Long were here today, he was at the same session I was at conference, not at MC, I hasten to add, where this was said as a very serious question by a member of the crowd. The wasting time in MySpace and that stuff. Should we turn it off, block it, so as to keep them from wasting their lives? Wow. Okay, how much more hostility can you put towards these spaces? And if you think that, geez, there are some analogies towards what I told you before about Cabrini Green. Yeah, you're right. It's exactly the same sort of language if you go back to the papers that were published in the 30s, 40s, 50s when Cabrini Green was mostly built. It's exactly the same language that was used by social reformers with the best of all intentions. Nobody was trying to be mean or evil here, saying, get rid of the nightclubs and the bars and the speakeasies and so on, because they're what's contributing to the downfall of this community, and if you took this away, they would be pure and wholesome. And we all know what's about. And the last one is from the latest issue of the New Yorker, and I saw this literally as I was packing up my bags the night before. I said, okay, I have to redo this slide just to include this. This is from an article on the dictionaries, the politics of dictionaries. It's mostly on Webster. So this is kind of a throwaway in the very last paragraph. It mentions Wiktionary, which, for those of you who don't know, is sort of the Wikipedia counterpart to the dictionary. Wikipedia is the counterpart to an encyclopedia, and Wiktionary is the counterpart to the dictionary. And the article ends with this, saying, different people say this about Wiktionary, but I say Wiktionary is Maoist. Now, I'm not sure the author knows what Maoist means, but okay, but it's clearly meant. And then this spit on it as an echo of an earlier sentence, and the guy's joking. In other words, this is, it is evil. This is beyond the it's all junk, which we started out with. This is downright, it's evil and I spit on it. Okay, these are not attitudes that are conducive, to put it mildly, to any sort of constructive use of these spaces. So you need to change language. It's fine, it's more than fine. It's required that you talk about critiquing with the space, constructing ways of looking at what's in these spaces. Nobody says that everything on MySpace is all sunshine and glory. I already told you about some of the segregation events in the 60s, and in fact we do see some counterparts of some of that in some spaces. Not so much in MySpace, but in some of the other more limited spaces. So, but this way, this is an attitude, it's the exact equivalent of shut down things, this destroys third places. Another thing is other members of the academic community, faculty, staff have to join and participate. It doesn't mean you need to get everybody on board. But if you want this to be a third place, it has to be the place where you have those equalizing capabilities. It's just your students who are there. It isn't functioning as a third place, at least in the sense that it's going to give you the type of advantage that you want to look for. And finally, logical bridges have to be built between the second place structures and these third places. Physical third places tend to have the bar is here, and I live there, therefore I go to this bar. It's already a logical structure. That's not the case in virtual spaces. You have to do some homework there. Now, I've got one more slide, which is the option to construct spaces. But before I go to that option, I want to start with sort of a caveat. And I'll do it with a musical illustration.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. Mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
All right. So the caveat here, the caution, if you will, is I want to talk for just a minute about the possibility of creating new spaces. But the caveat is, why did I play 16 tones, so I'm going, didn't see anything? Because of that line that says, I owe my soul to the company store. The company store was a formal creation of a third place by mining companies, all sorts of companies, but the mining company is in this particular case not being spoken to. And if you know something about the history of the company store, it wasn't just a place to go buy your groceries. It actually did function as a third place. In some cases, you had a gin parlor attached in England, for instance, which was quite popular. And you had all sorts of lock-in structures into that that actually resulted in some quite horrible situations, which our singer here is singing about, owing their soul to the company store. Right? Like sometimes the company issued scrip that you could only redeem at the company store and the gin parlor associated with it. Other times they didn't have to do that. It was enough to create it, to create an exclusionary sense, and this created, as I say, if you read the history of the company store and associated parlors, etc., it's really quite horrifying in terms of some of the structure they created, while at the same time they really were third places. So I caution people, you know, in the case of the companies, I don't think there was no evil intent, so to speak. I think there was really intent to keep people in their place, so to speak. But it is possible to create third places when you create a third place that's strongly associated with a place that has some of those overtones. At the same time, even if you do some things that go in that direction, there's also hope. I was speaking with one of my colleagues the other day about this talk, and I was going to mention this, and they said, yeah, but you know what? Remember, the modern-day cooperative workers' movements, in terms of functional cooperatives, sprung out of the company store. In other words, those third places were changed by people who said this is an unacceptable situation, and from that sprung the cooperative workers' unions and so on. So it's a very interesting history, but it is something to keep in mind as you're doing this in terms of make sure you don't create the company store. So what do I recommend if you're doing this? Well, first take the defining characteristics, you know, and the important results, those checklists I told you about, very seriously. And I'm going to give you the four that I think are particularly important. First one, don't brand or integrate the third place into WebCT, Blackboard, fill in the blank with your favorite CMS. This goes against that sense of the slightly run-down place. It also goes against the sense of neutrality. In other words, you've made it, this is this place over here, and only these people get to go there. Don't do that. You're going away from the third place idea. Do allow people from outside the academic institution to participate. A lot of people are scared about this. I don't know why. Some of the courses I've taught online, where we made sure that the blog was being indexed by Google and we had people just parachute in. It was a course on theories of how the brain works. I actually wasn't teaching this particular course, but I had set up the whole environment for the person who was teaching it. And suddenly they had brain specialists from hospitals, universities parachute in and say, I saw your blog, and it's very interesting what you're discussing, but are you aware of the research by X, Y, and Z? So the most fascinating experiences, but also essential for third places to be done. You don't want to make participation in the third place compulsory. Remember, that issue of neutrality. And finally, you do want to tolerate a reasonable amount of eccentric behaviors. There's a tendency sometimes to sanitize places like this in universities, colleges, and so on, and you have to be very careful with that. You don't want the type of behavior that becomes out-and-out bullying that drives people out the door. But there's a good deal of behavior that you might say, you look the other way, you tolerate it, because that's essential to, again, the spirit of the third place. I also recommend going deliberately for that stitched-together approach rather than saying, I will now hire a team to put together a monolithic thing, usually a monolithic thing that looks just like Blackboard or WebCT. Brian Lamb is speaking in the next round of sessions. Brian is one of the people who's a specialist in this type of stitching together. You can also speak with Alan Levine. He's another person who says, you know, take a little PHP, a little Python here, a blogging tool there, and put it together. Again, this goes to the sense of that somewhat shabby, but also a sense of character to it that you don't get with the monolithic type structures. You should view it as an ongoing experiment. Doesn't mean, oh, it's just an experiment and you drop it. It means this is not something you're ever going to really be done with, and you need to factor that in. And finally, take the existing sociological research, whether it's about online work or offline work, very seriously. And I hope I've given you a little bit of an introduction to that today. So, that's it for the talk. Any questions?
We made this commitment to bring all these Web 2.0 type tools online for the community, and then one of the big threads of the past few years is good citizenship in, you know, the immediate area, cross-curricular, cross-campus communications, and all that. And it's just interesting to me that every time we put one of these tools up there, whether it be a blog or a wiki or a podcast, the first request is always, how can we make this private? And just, you know, to go back with this third place idea, you know, and to be able to say, you know, is this really what you want? Do you really want to make it private? I don't know, it's just good for thought for me. And it's just peculiar, that's the tension there. Everyone sees the potential of it, but they're always like, how can I make this private to my class or to my, you know, campus?
Yeah, one thing I find that helps in that type of scenario is also talking through with people with why do you want it to be private and what do you see as private. I mean, some people throw out the word private, and sometimes they're not using it in the sense that they think they're using it, so to speak, and you can say, well, is this the feature that you're worried about? No, and then you say, well, okay, the features that you want will still be there, it's just not quite, you don't attain them by locking the key door and drawing the shades on the space. And I find that sometimes helping the discussion too.
Jared gave a great talk yesterday about evolution of virtual worlds. His six virtual worlds he's lived through, putting them in perspective to this is really, really interesting. And he said each one has always kind of like gotten popular and fallen and disappeared for some reason. Do you think that, in context with this, that this generation of virtual worlds will stick around longer because they actually have become sort of all the characteristics of these?
I think. Third place? I don't know the answer, obviously.
Right,
I can just make a guess, but I think yes. Yeah, obviously.
There are a lot of reasons why things failed in the past, too. I didn't get to see Jared's talk, but for instance, something like Second Life back in 99, when it was starting, it's like, okay, let's see, we need broadband and we need good graphics cards. Those aren't out right now. It won't be the way the world is for probably about 6 years or so. There were virtual worlds that did come out, but kind of folded off because I think they didn't have solid business models, and they also didn't have the technology didn't catch up enough.
Right.
It's kind of like people trying to, you know, build television sets when the technology would make the vacuum tubes weren't there quite yet. So, and then also a lot of, you know, there were, you know, every subsequent sort of virtual space, it's always, you know, company, you don't just go blindly into it. You go, okay, where did everyone screw up in the past, and where did they succeed, and where were they knocked down, not because of what they did, but because of just the way the market was at that point in time. So it's only going to get better, I think.
I'm terribly fascinated by this. And the technology side, I think that one of the things that I mentioned yesterday, even about the companies not going out of business, I think one of the things that I'm really excited about is, I know for a fact that the hardest thing is you can't tell the administration that we're building a bar. You're absolutely right. And every time we say that we need to build a community that is independent of the academic and pedagogical goals, and the academic and pedagogical goals only catch up if people catch up. And that, in that sense, and about closing the door, closing the door is about that elitism of, well, we're a big higher institution, The only trick that we've ever used, of course, was to say that we're going to use the recruiting tool, which of course then they try to brand it. And it becomes that sense of, how do we keep it informal? How do we grow that sense of, they do it without us, so we're just stealing the space.
Just going back for a second to the permanence question, I think there's some more permanence in the current generation. I think there's more oomph behind it. I mean, you look at what was the largest move that I heard? I remember it being in tens of thousands for a 3 week successful. So that's what we have. Look at MySpace, you look at millions. You look at, Linden Labs, and so what we have 1.3 million. So, you're looking at, there's much more momentum behind. And there's one more thing. I think that you're seeing tools appear. I could be wrong about this, but I think some of the tools you're seeing now have a certain interesting match to the structure of the dreams that pre-existed the tools. And you look at Second Life, and to me it's Snow Crash come to life. I mean, there are some aspects that aren't there yet, but if I look at Snow Crash as, the expression of a desire as to what could this be like, well, Second Life is actually getting pretty close, much, much closer than other things have been. So I think that in the same measure that you say Google has much more of the, it finally got close enough to find it form. Out it isn't quite good, right? With just a frequency detector. But Google, by using the, what have other people done by effectively linking to other people's implicit judgment, got much more to that dream of the ideal assistant that knows kind of what you have in mind, and in this case, knows by tapping it. Are they perfect? Are they exactly where they should be? No. Are they going to evolve? Absolutely. Could it be that some of these companies will go under? I bet that some of them will in fact not make it because sometimes that's just what happens. But I do think that I don't think you're in the situation where you'd be betting on something that will be dead in an hour's time.
I think we'll have to formally end this session right now because we do have a little up here just a few minutes, but I hope you'll continue the conversation throughout the day and at the reception following the next session. Thanks again, Ruben.